at kidscount.org. In the forecast, showers still likely tonight with lows in the mid-50s.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present a lecture from last semester's African American Studies program series entitled Blacks and Asians in the Making of the Modern World. The series examined a variety of subjects. Tonight's subject is illegal aliens from Africa, the clandestine slave trade to the United States from 1808 to 1859, and is presented by Professor Robert Hall of Northeastern University. Slavery, as we now know, was legal in many southern states right through the Civil War. However, the importing of slaves became illegal in 1808 and was then made a crime punishable by death in 1820. As we will hear tonight from Professor Hall, that still did not deter slavers from transporting thousands of blacks into the states from Africa and also from Cuba. To introduce Professor Hall is the director of Boston University's African American Studies program, Professor of History Ronald Richardson. Professor Richardson.
We are honored today to inaugurate this semester's series, the lecture by Robert Hall, who's associate professor in the Department of African American Studies and History at Northeastern University. Professor Hall received his PhD in history from Florida State University. He was one of the founders of African American Studies at Harvard University when he was a student there in the 60s. It is particularly gratifying for me to welcome Bob Hall today. When I started here January of 2000, as Director of African American Studies, Bob Hall was Director of African American Studies at Northeastern University and was the only director or chair of an African American Studies department in the area to go out of his way to welcome me. In fact, dropping by unannounced, unfortunately I wasn't in, to say hello, and I was very touched by that and appreciate that, and I'd like to thank you for making me feel at home. He didn't have to do that. Without further ado, I'd like to ask all of you, join with me in welcoming Professor Robert Hall, who will speak to us today on illegal aliens from Africa, the clandestine slave trade to the United States, 1808 to 1859. Thank you.
I guess I'm in the conventional mode today. For one of the relatively few times in my life, I've actually prepared a talk word for word. So I think that rather than to ramble at midnight or any other time of day, I'm going to read it. The clandestine importation of African captives into the United States after the outlawing of the overseas slave trade by Congress in 1807 has remained an intriguing topic for historians and the general public alike. This talk attempts to do three things. Number one, sort out and reconcile the competing estimates of the volume of this trade, admittedly hard to estimate because it was illegal. Second, to identify the major geographical areas of the United States into which the illegals were transported and the relative importance of those areas. And third, and perhaps most important from the cultural history point of view, to explore the cultural baggage that the last generations of imported African laborers brought with them. And that's the principal interest that I have in the broader context of the cultural history of the transatlantic slave trade. Every once in a while, we can get a sighting of some of the illegals, including photographs of survivors of late illegal voyages from the 1850s. And some of these individuals have been interviewed by linguistically trained anthropologists and by folklorists and heads of theological schools, etc. And so we get a kind of capsule that from which to project backward into the adjustments of others in the period of the legal slave trade. By 1783, Maryland, like Virginia, had acquired a sufficient black population to supply its labor needs as well as those of other states through the natural increase of the then mostly country-born slave population. upon examining changing demographic patterns among African-derived slave communities in the Western Hemisphere, we are hard-pressed to resist the notion that at least some planters in the United States had a conscious or semi-conscious population policy vis-a-vis the slave population, i.e., grow your own. When captives were cheap in Africa, European slave buyers allowed skewed sex ratios among their captive African imports, with an overwhelming preponderance of males over females being the norm. But when prices in Africa began to rise, North American buyers of slaves began to seek a better balanced sex ratio, both because women were cheaper on the American side, though not necessarily on the African side, and as a means of obtaining a self-sustaining slave population. When the issue of the overseas slave trade was debated at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut was essentially correct to observe that, and I quote him, "Slaves also multiply so fast in Virginia and Maryland that it is cheaper to raise than import them. Whilst in the sickly rice swamps, foreign supplies are necessary. If we go further than is urged, we shall be unjust toward South Carolina and Georgia." As is well known, the result of the debate was Article 1, Section A of the Constitution, which reads, "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importations, not exceeding $10 for each person." By the time the clause was drafted, the majority of the African-born ancestors of Americans had completed their involuntary migration to North America, and several states had already prohibited the overseas slave trade in African captives: Delaware in 1776, Virginia in 1778, Pennsylvania in 1780, and so on. Following the convention, Georgia would exercise its constitutional right to engage in the overseas slave trade until 1798, and with a temporary suspension in 1787, South Carolina would do so until 1807, including a last-ditch flurry of importation of over 39,000 Africans during the last 4 years of the legal overseas slave trade. In rendering the importation of slaves anywhere in the United States a crime in 1807, Congress was outlawing the trade at the earliest constitutionally permissible time. Although there is no doubt that illegal aliens from Africa continued to be forced into North America after January 1, 1808, several questions remain. Who should be counted as an illegal alien from Africa? How should their numbers be estimated? And how many Africans actually arrived illegally between 1808 and 1865? If considerable controversy has raged during the last three decades about the number of Africans imported legally as slaves into the United States between, let us say, the 1620s and 1807, consensus over how many Africans were imported illegally between 1808 and 1860s is even harder to obtain. In a statement that is way out of line with even the upper limits of the most extensive previous estimates of the volume of the illegal slave trade, they may be forgiven perhaps because they are art historians, Michael Teague and Zaleed Cowan said that an estimated 10 to 12,000 slaves had to be smuggled into the U.S. annually after 1812 to meet this demand. But if you think about it, if from 1813 to 1860 an annual average of 10,000 Africans had been imported, the total volume would have been 480,000, a number that exceeds the most conservative estimate of the total number of imports into North America. And that conservative estimate of the total attempts to include the volume of the illegal. The conservative estimate is curtains, which was once as low as 427,000, but that has been revised upwards, stands now at just shy of 600,000, according to James Rawley. But in any case, if Teague and Cowan are right, the number imported illegally exceeds the estimates for the total, subsuming the illegals in the previous estimates. Now, acceptance of such a high annual average, which also exceeds the most reliable estimate of annual rates during the 18th century peak of the slave trade, led Teague and Cowan to conclude, erroneously, I believe, that it was in the first half of the 19th century that the ancestors of most American Negroes were brought to this country from Africa. That probably is not the case. The proportion is more like 12% arrived illegally, relying on curtains. At another end of the spectrum, but without offering specific estimates, Eugene D. Genovese characterized the smuggling of Africans into the United States after 1807 as statistically insignificant. Following Curtin, probably no more than 427,000 to 455,000 Africans were transported into the United States, including the hard-to-estimate illegal importations after 1807. Estimates of the size of the illegal trade obviously vary widely. In 1859 and 1860, the Tallahassee Floridian and Journal newspaper estimated that 250,000 Africans have been imported into the United States between 1808 and 1860. The New York Post estimated that between 30,000 and 60,000 have been imported illegally into the South. W.B. Du Bois, Lewis Gray, an agricultural historian, and W.H. Collins thought that between 250 and 270,000 arrived illegally during the entire span from 1808 to 1860. Building on the demographer Jack Eblen's estimate that about 40,000 enslaved Africans were imported into the United States between 1820 and 1860, Curtin estimated that probably no more than 54,000 Africans were brought illegally to the United States during that whole period, 1808 to 1865. Just a note about Eblen. Eblen was a demographer who was using the life tables that had been developed to try to identify the birth rates or growth rates of the U.S. Slave population. And his estimate of 40,000 illegals between 1820 and 1860 is basically the residue of what's not accounted for by the projected birth rates using the life tables that have been developed for slaves. And so that's extrapolation from census data and should be considered a bare minimum for the volume of the illegal trade. The annual importation rate of 1,000 for the period 1820 to 1860 was considerably lower than the rate of 4,371 per year for the period 1741 to 1807, which is generally considered to be the peak of the 18th century importation into the United States, or to what colonies that became the United States, 4,371 a year. Depending on the size of the ships and the location of the African coastal shipping points, two or three full illegal cargoes a year could have sustained the average annual rate of importation implied by the corresponding estimates of Curtin and Eblen. This is suggested by what we know about the size of a few illegal cargoes that have been documented. The yacht Wanderer landed about 400 Africans in the Savannah River area in 1850. The bark E.A. Rawlings landed almost 700 captives in Texas during the summer of 1858. Another cargo entering Texas in June of 1852 contained 400 Africans, and the bark Wildfire, captured in 1860 off the coast of Florida, contained 300 African captives. So if Eblen's estimate of 1,000 a year over that period, 1820 to 1860, holds up, one need envision no more than 3 to 6 arrivals a year, depending on the size of the cargoes. The closer you get to the end of the slave trade, the greater the concentration of origins in the Congo-Angola area, and the size, average size of cargoes going out of Congo-Angola coastal shipping points tended to be larger than the average size cargoes coming out of some other points further up the coast. In 1858, several cargoes of illegal Africans were reported to have landed, and the issue intruded into Abraham Lincoln's campaign for Congress. There is more agreement among competing estimates about the volume of illegal slave importation between 1820 and 1860 than there is for the earlier period, 1808 to 1820. The African Society of London estimated that between 1808 and 1816, 15,000 of the 60,000 captives taken annually from Africa were shipped by Americans. But this does not necessarily mean that all or even most of them were deposited in the United States. Whereas Kenneth Stamp, following the statistical breakdown, I'll be through with these numbers soon, of W.H. Collins estimated that as many as 60,000 illegals were imported between 1808 and 1820. Alan Kulikov suggested that only 7,000 were smuggled during that period. And so you add up some of the estimates. If you add Collins and Stamp for 1808 to 1820 to those of Curtin and Evelyn for 1820 to 1860, that would yield a total of 100,000 for the total period. If you substituted Kulikov's estimate of 7,000 for Stamp's 60,000 and added that to the Curtin Evelyn figure of 40, you would get 47,000. So my suggestion is that the range is between 47,000 and 100,000 rather than some of the larger numbers that have been cited by Collins, even by Du Bois and by the Tallahassee Floridian. I just want to give you one example of people who probably would be classified as illegal, but who probably would not show up in a count based on intercensual years. In March of 1822, several Africans were rescued from the slave trade and eventually left Baltimore on the brig Strong, with Collins being transported to Liberia under the auspices of the American Colonization Society. They had been aboard a Spanish slaving vessel, also illegal according to Spanish law passed in 1820, when they were captured by an American privateer who attempted unsuccessfully to smuggle them into St. Luke's Parish in South Carolina. Would these victims of the Atlantic slave trade be included in estimates based on census data? Probably not. Should they be counted among America's African illegal aliens? Aliens? Probably so. Although agreement about the volume of the illegal trade is hard to reach, anecdotal evidence attesting to the persistence of the practice after 1808 enables us to identify the principal destination states for the illegal trade. On the Atlantic coast, South Carolina and Georgia, the two original 13 colonies where the legal trade had persisted the longest, continued to receive African forced immigrants well beyond 1808. Along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama can be shown to have received illegals. Finally, sparsely settled Florida, with long coastlines on both the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf Coast, appears to have been quite vigorously involved in importation and or detention of illegal importees. In 1807, when the penalties for violators of the new law abolishing the overseas trade were being discussed in Congress, Florida was still a Spanish territory whose laws permitted enslaved Africans to be landed beyond the reach of American law. There were significant slave trading bases in Florida, which was a Spanish territory technically until 1821. And it became a kind of bone of contention because slaves were brought in there legally up until 1820 and then smuggled into Georgia. And one of those traders was a chap named Zephaniah Kingsley, whose wife was African and whose name was Anna Majijin Jai, J-A-I. And they had a plantation at Fort George Island in Florida. And there was also Amelia Island in the off the northernmost part, northeasternmost part of Florida, was another active area of smuggling into the United States. Not clear whether those people should be or have been counted as illegal aliens imported into the United States. When it comes to Florida, there was also a trade between Cuba and Florida, and there are wildly clashing estimates of the volume and the significance of the illegal Cuba to Florida trade. But undoubtedly, some Africans bound for Cuba, like the eight individuals on the schooner Emperor in 1831, ended up in Florida via this clandestine business. Milo, one of the eight, said not only that he was from Africa, but that he was brought here from Havana. Another exemplar of the movement of slaves from Cuba and between Cuba and Florida is the Lukumi captive, that is of Yoruba extraction, encountered near St. Mary's, Florida, by the Swedish novelist Fredrika Bremer during her visit in 1851. The Lukumi man she met was, as she put it, tattooed like the Lukumi she had seen in Cuba. In her account, Bremer also indicated that there were three major cabildos or religious societies in Cuba, each one closely identified with a major African nation or nationality or ethnic group. The Cabildo de Señora Santa Barbera de la Nación Lukumi Alagua, Cabildo de Gangas de Gongos, and the Cabildo de Congos. When Bremer asked the middle-aged African man, "You come hither from Africa?" he replied, "Yes," that he had been smuggled hither from Cuba many years ago. Other African captives were usually detained for periods ranging from a few months to several years before the workings of the criminal justice system ground to their conclusion. In 1827, for example, when a cargo of illegal forced immigrants from Africa was detained in Florida, 89 of the all-male cargo, judged to be old enough and well enough to work, were hired out while the litigation was in process. 36 of them were hired out to this Zephaniah Kingsley that I referred to before, who remained in Florida once the transfer from Spain to the United States occurred. He kept them until the U.S. Marshal came to claim them in 1829, and they were transported to Africa in a ship whose name we can retrieve from the record. Sometime after 1827, several Africans arriving from the Antelope, captured in 1820 by an American cutter and taken to Savannah, were awarded to claimants and eventually became slaves in Florida. The disposition of these and other African recaptors from the cargo of that vessel had been a bone of legal and diplomatic contention for 7 years before some of the survivors were sent to Florida and others to Liberia. Louisiana, acquired from France by the United States in 1803, was another locus of illegal slave trading, but probably on a smaller scale than in Florida. Shipping columns appearing in Havana, Cuba's Papel Periodico on May 5, 1808 and September 28, 1809 indicate that at least two American vessels departed Havana headed for New Orleans after the congressional ban had gone into effect. In 1808, the American schooner James was bound for New Orleans with 43 Negros Bozales, that is African-born. And in 1809, the American frigate Franklin headed for New Orleans from Cuba with 45 blacks aboard. We cannot be certain that any of these 88 folk reached New Orleans, but if they did so, it would have been illegally. Also, the bayous of the Barataria district below New Orleans were rife with illegal slaving activities. Another apparently profitable locale for illegal slave trading was Texas. Eugene C. Barker, while researching the subject during the late 1800s and early 1900s, corresponded with W.P. Zuber and about 50 other surviving members of the Texas Veterans Association. Six of his correspondents were able to provide specific information. But, to quote Barker, "it is thought best to withhold the names of those who engaged in this expedition." So in Barker's publication, we don't know the names of it. Perhaps in Barker's notes, which I suspect are deposited at the Barker Center at the University of Texas, which is named after him, would reveal that. In 1833, according to Barker, three unnamed prominent citizens landed a full cargo of Africans that they had acquired from Cuban slave traders. Several hundred blacks had been signed to three-year terms of indenture and therefore entered Texas technically as free colored immigrants. But after clearing the slave patrols and landing their passengers in Texas, the business partners to this venture got the Africans to sign still another labor contract, which probably unbeknownst to them, bound them to service for 99 years. James W. Fannin Jr. and Ben Fort Smith were probably among the Texans engaged in the illegal trade in 1833, in the African trade in 1833 and 1834. At this time, of course, Texas was not legally a part of the United States, but a restive province of Mexico. During the fall of 1835 and the winter of 1836, disruption caused by the war for Texas independence created further business opportunities in the slave trade. Late in February 1836, the schooner Shenandoah entered a Texas port carrying 171 Africans. Monroe Edwards said he left Cuba with 185 Africans aboard, indicating a mortality rate of 7.6% during the trip from Cuba to Texas. Writing in 1902, Barker again says some of the Africans who were brought in during the period of the Republic are still living, in fact, along the coast from Matagorda to Velasco and along the banks of the Brazos and Colorado rivers. They are not at all uncommon. Although, as Randolph B. Campbell has noted, engaging in the Atlantic slave trade was outlawed by the Constitution of the Republic, the African trade supplied a few of the slaves who arrived between 1836 and 1861. Campbell says perhaps as many as 2,000. I know others who argue that that's way too low. Some of the Africans taken into Texas between 1817 and 1856 probably have been introduced first into Louisiana. And I have just sort of one example to illustrate that is a man that I have interviewed myself, Charlie Smith of Bartow, Florida, who I interviewed in 1972 when he was about 126 years old. And then he died in 1979 in his 130s or 140s. We don't know exactly, but we do know that he was born in Liberia, probably of Americo-Liberian parentage, and that sometime about the age of 12, he was enticed onto a vessel and sold at market in Louisiana, but purchased by a Texas rancher, where he spent the rest of his days as a slave. And then after slavery, he began migrating eastward, working in the forest industries, turpentine, lumber in Alabama, and then eventually getting to Bartow, Florida, where he worked in the citrus groves, when he was discovered, in quotes, by the Social Security Administration at the tender age of 113. His discovery was inspired by a revision of the Social Security Act of 1834, which expanded the covered categories of workers to include agricultural workers. And so Charlie went to the paymaster one day after this revision went into effect, and the paymaster said, "Charlie, you got a Social Security card?" And Charlie said, "Social Security card, what's that? I ain't never seen that Social Security card." He said, "That's all right, don't worry about it. Federal government say that from now on we got to take money out your paycheck." That's the way they translated the Social Security. So he paid benefits into the system from 113 till he retired at 126. And after that, he ran a candy store on Palmetto Street in Bartow. But he was one of those illegals. And some people... Oh, well, that's what he was known in the United States. His name in Liberia was Mitchell Watkins.
And how old was he when he was grown?
12.
12?
12.
Roughly. What year? 1840?
45 or so. Yeah.
Did he have a family?
In the United States?
Liberia, anyway.
Oh, yeah. He had, yeah. His family shows up in school records and mission school records and baptismal records in Liberia. But those were before he was born. So there's a American Liberian family named Watkins who show up in the Liberian records. When I first, quote, discovered Charlie, or when I first interviewed him, I remembered an old friend that I had encountered across Xerox machine at Norman Copy on Mass Ave in Cambridge, an anthropologist named Sven Holse, H-O-L-S-O-E, and he was a specialist in Liberian studies. And there was a Liberian studies newsletter. He was at University of Delaware in the early 70s, and I wrote him, and he had transcribed some of these records, and I told him about Mitchell Watkins. And he looked him up, and he said that he had earlier baptismal records, but that he didn't find Charlie. And then the age question, once he was listed in Ripley's Believe It or Not as the oldest man, living man or whatever, and then somebody challenged that. I don't believe he ever was the oldest living person. There are plenty of people in Georgia, in Russia, and in the Peruvian Andes, the little pockets of people that have long life. And Charlie was just the oldest working man when he was discovered at age 113. And there was a Ripley's Believe It or Not that featured him and this 150-some-year-old guy, Javier Pereira, from the Andes. But, you know, Charlie's logic was, this here, the oldest man, I'm the second oldest, he died, that make me the oldest. So, anyway, but Charlie would be an example of one of those introduced first into Louisiana and then taken to Texas during this window between 1817 and 1856. Yeah, he was. Yeah, while he was in Texas, yeah. But some of his other history gets distorted or got distorted after he was discovered because he felt that if he didn't know answers to trivia questions that people, visitors, ask him, that would cast doubt on his age. So he said, people likes to have facts in the stories, so I puts facts in them. And so you couldn't ask him something that he didn't know but once. And then the next time, he would turn that around to the next visitor and say, Mister, do you know about Gitto? You know the man what shot Garfield, Charles Gitto. I was a graduate student. I didn't know about Charles Gitto. I had to go back and look him up. We do have a marriage record from Tallahassee. He was married to Annie Banks in Tallahassee. But unfortunately, there's no indication of age on the marriage record. I mean, he told us the name of his most recent wife. He knew I was from Tallahassee. He said, you from Tallahassee, miss? He said, last time I got married was in Tallahassee. And I said, do you remember the name of your wife? Which could have been an insulting question. But he drew a blank for about 15 seconds. And he said, yeah, her name Annie. Annie Banks. But that's another story. That's another story, as interesting as it may be. Now, among the Gulf Coast states, Mississippi and Alabama also appear to have received smuggled Africans. Although we cannot tell whether they had been imported directly into Mississippi, African-born people could be sighted as late as 1859, when the Vicksburg Sun carried an advertisement stating, any person visiting the slave depot on Mulberry Street in this city can get a sight of some of the latest importations of Congo Negroes. And they may have meant that literally.
What year was that?
1859. One of the best-known examples of illegal cargoes of Africans arriving in Alabama, and one of the last known slavers to arrive in the United States as a whole, was the Clotilda, which arrived near Mobile in 1859. Located in a quaint corner in the area of Mobile is a community called Africatown, formed originally by the survivors of this voyage. The voyage was a rather lengthy one, lasting about 70 days. Driven by the fear of detection of his illegal activities, the captain, William Foster, sailed mostly at night and veered off course at the first sight of an oncoming vessel. Yet, despite the unusual length of the voyage, 108 of the 110 captives arrived alive off the coast of Alabama, just below Fort Morgan. The Mobile-based vessel was returning to Mobile Bay, loaded with its human cargo from the Guinea coast and with federal patrols in hot pursuit. Captain Foster, fearful of being arrested for the capital crime of treason in 1820, engaging in illegal slave trading had been defined as treason punishable by death. He released the Africans and scuttled and burned the vessel, leaving a charred hulk that could still be seen beneath 15 or 20 feet of water half a century after its arrival. Most of the Africans participated in establishing a settlement in Plateau, where several hundred of their descendants still live today. The best known of these survivors from the ill-fated voyage of the Clotilda was Cujo Lewis. His African name was rendered in Zora Neale Hurston's Dust Tracks on a Road as Kosolo Ololue. He lived until 1935 and was interviewed and photographed by a number of persons, including the folklorist Arthur Huff Fawcett. Lewis's bust stands in front of the Union Baptist Church, which was founded by several of the survivors in the 1860s. Sometime during the second decade of the 20th century, G. Lake Imes, dean of the Bible Training School in Tuskegee, Alabama, visited a colony of survivors of the Clotilda in Plateau. There he found what he termed 9 weather-beaten, grizzled old men and women, the remnant of the last cargo of slaves brought to American soil from the coast of Africa. The youngest of the 9, Kosolo or Cujo Lewis, who had been about 18 when the Clotilda arrived, was approaching 76 years old when Imes interviewed him. The oldest of the 9 altogether was not less than 110 at the time Imes interviewed them around 1917. The story that these wizened survivors told Imes reveals much about both the dynamics of the slave trade and the process of adjustment once the Africans reached American shores. Paraphrasing what the survivors had told him during his visit to their community in 1917, Imes said, "One day messengers from Dahomey appeared suddenly on the borders of Tiko and demanded tribute in the name of their tribes. Eventually, 100 captives, including the 18-year-old Kosolo, were taken and transported to Widi, spelled U-I-D-I, probably Wida, W-H-Y-D-A-H, a port town. These and other captives, totaling about 110, were transported to the hold of the ship Clotilda. Upon their arrival in 1859, none of the Africans aboard spoke English. Although many of them initially vowed to return to Africa if emancipated, there have been no reports that any of the members of the cargo ever did. Instead, after the end of the Civil War, they converted to Christianity, began building a church and purchasing homes, and lived out the rest of their lives in the United States. Aunt Juma, one of the 9 survivors, was the oldest, and according to Imes, her kindly beaming face is all the more interesting for the strange marks of adornment it bears, made in the flesh after the custom of her tribe. The remains of Orse Kibbe, Polly Allen, Cujo Lewis, Kazumo Leviston, and other survivors from the Clotilda are buried in the clay of the Africatown Cemetery on the outskirts of Mobile. Illegal slave trading persisted in South Carolina and Georgia as late as 1858. The 30 to 40 previously mentioned Africans were imported illegally into Georgia in 1818. In the 1820s, also previously mentioned, the unsuccessful attempt to import into St. Luke's Parish in South Carolina. The arrival in 1858 of the slave ship Wanderer, carrying a cargo of about 400 Africans obtained near the mouth of what was called the Congo River, was one of the last known landings of smuggled Africans in South Carolina and Georgia. About 170 of the Africans were sent up the Savannah River in the steamboat Augusta and landed on a plantation of a relative of the owner of the boat. Small parcels of the wanderers' cargo were sold into Florida, which is where I first encountered them in my research on Florida. And several large parcels, among them the seven survivors interviewed in the early 20th century by University of Chicago anthropologist Charles J. Montgomery, were sold in South Carolina. Montgomery, who had linguistic training, interviewed and photographed seven African-born survivors of the 1858 voyage of the Wanderer who were living in South Carolina 47 years after their entry as illegal aliens into the United States. His field work yielded a treasure trove of cultural and linguistic information. Although all of the individuals are known in their American communities by anglicized names, six of the seven knew their African names and repeated them when interviewed by Montgomery. The seven survivors were Zao Ankola, Tom Johnson, Manchuela, Katie Noble, Mabiala, Ulster Williams, Lucy Lanham, Silukanji, Ward Lee, Puke Giata, Tucker Henderson, and Taro, or Romeo. The voyage that brought the seven survivors and about 402 others obtained its human cargo near the mouth of the Congo River. Zao Ankola, who stated that he came from the coast of Africa where the sun rises, may have come either from the Indian Ocean coast or from the western shore of one of the larger lakes in East Africa. The others appear to have come from Central Africa in and around the Congo Basin. Mabiala, who came from the Bizi River area, explained his misfortune of being enslaved as a result of having a spell put on him by witchcraft. Lucy Lanham recalled the name of her chieftain, Mfotila, and a mountainous country beyond the Congo. Silugansi lived in the village of Kowani before being taken captive, and he remembered his mother's home village was Kolumbandi. Taro was a grown man when he arrived in South Carolina in 1858. Shortly after his arrival, he built a straw house like the one he had occupied in Africa. Montgomery also took down word lists, including examples of African counting systems, which enable us to place the Africans linguistically with a fair amount of confidence. Among the significant words contained in the list were words referring to foodstuffs like corn, masa, and manioc, mandioca. But perhaps most interesting of all was the word for peanuts, gubas, which had been common currency in the regional dialects of both blacks and whites in many parts of the rural South, and which is derived from the Central African Bantu cluster of languages. Additional anecdotal evidence provides some powerful and tantalizing clues about both the Old World origins of the illegal African newcomers and the cultural adjustments they had to make. Skip that one. Between 1834 and 1854, about 50 slavers were captured by U.S. patrols and taken to New York. Others were taken to Key West, Florida, when captured. And in 1859, a ship was captured in St. Joseph's Bay near Tallahassee, Florida, after some 600 or 700 Africans had been landed somewhere on the coast of Florida. Accounts of the arrival of cargoes of Africans confiscated in mixed patches on the high seas and of their behavior upon landing in U.S. ports clearly established the carrying over of such cultural practices as burial ceremonies. In May 1860, the U.S. gunboats Mohawk and Wyandotte captured the slavers Wildfire and Williams and took 500 emaciated Africans ashore at Key West, Florida. According to Jefferson Beal Brown, who was alive at the time, nearly all were suffering from ophthalmia while many were totally blind. Shortly after their arrival in Key West, one of the African children died. Brown gave the following description of the burial ceremony. The interment took place some distance from the barracoon, and the Africans were allowed to be present at the services where they performed their native ceremony. Weird chants were sung, mingled with wails of grief and mournful moanings from 100 throats, until the coffin was lowered into the grave, when at once the chanting stopped and perfect silence reigned, and the Africans marched back to the barracoons without a sound. think I'm going to summarize the rest of this. That's the culture material. The rest of this has to do with a different way in which the United States was involved in the overseas slave trade that was not involving direct importation of African captives. And I can summarize this. Just as during the period between 1808 and 1820, when the Spanish outlawed the overseas slave trade, the Spanish flag was a kind of guardian angel for slavers from any other countries that were engaging in the trade. And Spanish flag was sort of standard equipment, and that would be run up when patrols were approaching. Later on, Spain entered into what was known as equipment treaties with England, which gave the British patrols permission to board Spanish vessels looking for illegals, and if they found them, they could confiscate them and liberate them. Now, the Americans were very touchy, going all the way back to the impressment issue before the War of 1812, were very touchy about its rights to neutral shipping on the high seas and declined to enter into these equipment treaties until very late in the game. And so, ironically, and perhaps perversely, the American flag became a kind of guardian angel for the illegal slave trade. American flag was standard equipment. And if ship was sighted on the horizon that might have been a British slave squadron, Africa squadron, then whatever flag they were flying under was taken down and the American flag was run up and the British would be loath to board them for fear of a diplomatic and international incident. Lord Palmerston referred to this practice as juggling with flags. The U.S. did have an Africa squadron late in the game, but it was pulled back the same year that the treaty allowing England to board American ships was passed in 1862. It was pulled back to deal with the Confederates during the Civil War. So I don't have a profound conclusion, but to deal with those first three points that I indicated were the main thrust. Looking at the previous estimates, I have suggested that a reasonable range, attempting to reconcile those various estimates, is not less than 47,000 between 1808 and 1860, and probably not more than 100,000, which is the upper end of that range is almost twice as high as Curtin's estimate of 54,000 illegals, but more than half as large as Du Bois and Gray and W.H. Collins. But the numbers were not my primary concern, but you can't deal with any of the rest of the aspects of the slave trade without addressing what I call the numbers game. Then we identified the major areas where illegal slaves or smuggled slaves were landed. I guess the principal observation is that I have not found any significant evidence of smuggling into Virginia and Maryland during the period from 1808 to 1860, which probably is in keeping with Oliver Ellsworth's observation at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 that Maryland and Virginia had pretty much grown their own slave population by that time. They had crossed the thresholds of self-reproduction as early as the 1720s or 1730s, whereas states like South Carolina did not cross that threshold until the 1760s. And South Carolina was the last state that still had legal slave trade during the last 4 years and imported 10,000 a year, which is was way above the average for the period 1741 to 1770s, which was about 4,300. So in terms of the numbers, now so geographically, Florida was on both coasts. You know, there was an Atlantic coast and a Gulf coast, and slaves appear to have been smuggled on both sides, like from Amelia Island on the Atlantic coast and into Apalachicola and other places near Tallahassee. On the Gulf Coast, there's evidence or sightings of illegal Africans being imported into Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. So the strand runs from South Carolina on around the Gulf Coast and on to Texas. And the two major cargoes of late arrivals, 1858 and 1859, the Clotilda in Alabama and the Wanderer in Georgia and South Carolina, provide a considerable amount of cultural and linguistic information. And that's the end of my story.
Northeastern University Professor Robert Hall speaking on illegal aliens from Africa, the clandestine slave trade to the United States from 1808 to 1859. Professor Hall's lecture was one of a series presented last semester by Boston University's African American Studies program entitled Blacks and Asians in the Making of the Modern World. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette with help from Boris Stropotsky, John Perotti, and Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining.